This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations we want to have. The conversations we need to have.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
What do you think? Will you vote for a candidate from Community Strong Australia? Have you heard about that yet? Yes, it's been on the cards for a while. Now it is official, a new federal party. Zali Steggall and Allegra Spender have set up Community Strong Australia. What do you think of the name, by the way? Registration papers were filed yesterday. They have a logo, a constitution. They don't have a leader. No captain's picks in this party because there is no captain. They are talking about a different way of being a party. I'll be kicking off the conversation hour today with Zali Steggall, and we'll get a sense of what her party is about. You'll hear from her. They're promising a wholly different, more collaborative way to run a party. Does that resonate with you? Will that win your vote? Do you think it's going to work? If you were tempted to vote One Nation, you've had enough of Labor and Liberals, would you instead consider a party of former independents in this new party, Community Strong Australia? Soon, Zali Steggall, and then a little bit of analysis as well from The Hill. Also, get ready to call during this conversation hour with your questions if you have an anxious pet. What is anxiety in a pet? We're here to give some advice today. My question about my golden retriever, she is undeniably skittish, but is she anxious? She jumps at plastic bags. If we put boxes in a new place around the house, she won't walk past them unaccompanied. We say, oh no, we have to guide her past the ghosts. Is that anxiety? Needing medication? I hear a lot of people giving medication to their pets. Or is that part of the breed? How will I know the difference? When I check it past the wisdom of the dog park, I must say it's gone both ways. What does a true blue expert say today? We're going to hear. If you have an anxious pet, or maybe you're anxious that you might have an anxious pet, whether it's your dog or your cat or your parrot, our expert can talk about that also, potentially, the role of human expectations in our pet's anxiety. It might just come down to that. What does your anxious pet do? We'll be talking about that in about 20 minutes. But first on The Conversation Hour, Zali Steggall starting a party.
This is The Conversation Hour with Mary Guerin.
So what is Community Strong Australia all about? On the line now is Zali Steggall, who along with Allegra Spender is behind Community Strong Australia. Zali Steggall, thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
Tell us about the new party.
Oh, look, Community Strong is about expanding and, you know, I guess complementing the community independent movement that has enabled communities to have their true voice and participate in politics, but it's limited to certain communities. So this is an opportunity to broaden the movement, bring more communities to the table, because we know so many Australians are feeling politically homeless. They are frustrated with the major party. They don't like the status quo. And there is a rise of, I guess, the far right and as an alternative. And I feel strongly we have an opportunity and a responsibility to step up and give communities and people around Australia a different choice, a choice that is focused on bringing us together with sensible solutions on key policy areas that so many people are worried about.
So it's reported it's you and Allegra Spender. Is it just you two? Is that enough for a party?
Well, absolutely, it is enough. We've lodged the forms, but it's an invitation to Australians and communities to get engaged, right? We are at a time with so many issues. Many people feel anxious and frustrated, but staying on the sidelines doesn't fix the problems. You actually need to step in. And we believe in active hope, in getting involved and building a system from the communities up to create better politics. Now, we're also going to continue having conversations with our colleagues and absolutely respect that they can now take the constitution of Community Strong Australia and consult with their communities and their supporters and volunteers. And we hope they will choose to maybe join in the future, but also work with us as allies in supporting upper house Senate tickets to enable communities to be represented in both houses.
And I want to get to the priorities of this new party very soon. But just while we're on those other colleagues, are you disappointed that more independents didn't join you? And what was the sticking point?
Look, it's very not disappointed. I absolutely respect. I'm in my third term, so I think compared to other independents, Helen Haynes is the only other one, that came in at the same time as me in 2019. And I respect that for everyone, it's a journey and it's a consultation process with your community. And also being clear about this isn't a compromise in that there is a free vote. So members of Community Strong Australia continue to be able to, and actually are required in the Constitution, to put their community at the forefront of their consideration on merits of legislation. There is no party line, there's no party power brokers behind the scenes compelling votes. And so we're trying to take the very best of the community independent movement and its attributes, but also the administrative and structural necessities of a party formation to enable a ticket for the Senate, for the upper house, but also some economies of scales across members and different communities.
You're listening to Zali Steggall. We're talking about a brand new party here in Australia on the Conversation Hour. Zali, we've heard from Zoe Daniel on RAF's show this morning saying that what you're doing is really brave because there's going to be a lot of armchair warriors and lots of analysis and journalists, she says, and political apparatchiks trying to pull this apart before it even stands up. Is that what you're expecting as well?
Maybe from some, but I think overwhelmingly the feedback from communities, from Australians that are frustrated with the status quo, is they really welcome this. They're ready for the challenge of building something new, a new era of Australian politics. And I guess for the doubters, look, through my sporting career, you know, no one ever thought we could be world champions in ski racing or medal at the Winter Olympics, and many had their doubts, and then many didn't think I could defeat Tony Abbott in Warringah, and yet here we are. So I think I'm up for the challenge. I know Allegra is up for the challenge, and we want to have this invitation out to Australia.
Zali Steggall, you are, of course, a sports person, and all sporting teams have their captains, but you don't have a leader for this party. How's that going to work?
Well, there's no I in team, right? And everyone always thinks about leadership and needing to have that one voice. I don't think you get the best outcomes that way. We bring to the table different attributes and strengths, and that's what we value. There's only Allegra and I at the moment.
So what happens if there's a dead heat?
We respect and have worked really collaboratively together. In fact, in the 4 years since Allegra's been in Parliament, we've probably voted similarly over 90% of the time. So we are values aligned in reflecting our community wishes. It's not necessary. Too many people associate leadership with power and having like the power of veto over where things go. And I think that's what people are so frustrated with the major parties at the moment, that there's that sense that good policy doesn't get up. And if you think about leadership, I mean, the Liberal Party has a president in Tony Abbott and a parliamentary leader in Angus Taylor. Who is really calling the shots? Who decides the policy, right? And so I think it's more important to build a strong team than it is to focus on leadership.
1300 222 774, does this resonate with you? What do you think of Community Strong Australia? Zali Steggall, who's funding Community Strong Australia?
We are obviously going to need support from the community and individual Australians to step up. I don't have a Gina Reinhart offering me a plane, may I say.
Climate 200?
No, Climate 200 is not part of this. They are focused on the community independent movement, and I respect that. They've done an amazing job in supporting that. I have, for my last three elections, overwhelmingly, been supported by my community, by individual Australians who really want to see stronger climate action, sensible economic management, integrity, equality, all the things that I'm committed to continue working hard for. So anyone that resonates with, please go to communitystrong.org.au and check out the constitution, the policies, and please sign up to donate or to be part of this.
How much do you need?
Well, we are up against the big party machines, right? And they did rig the game at the last term. They changed the donation rule laws to enable major parties embed their advantage, and they locked out competition. And we know that that was done on purpose. So that's one of the, I guess, the architectural needs for a party is to counter those changes to the donation reform laws and spending. But it's also the practicalities of getting representation in the Senate. It requires a party registration. And it enables us to collectively come together, bring communities together for I think, a stronger Australia. So, but yes, we do need those donations and support. So I think people have to think, do you want, only Gina to have a seat at the table through One Nation, or do we want communities with a seat at the table?
Zali Steggall, I'm really appreciative of your time because you've given us a lot, but I must ask you, there'll be people who'll be listening to these wonderful words you're talking, even the word, the branding itself, community strong. How can you disagree with that? But what does it really mean? You've said, you've been reported to say it's a centrist party, not a centre-right replacement, not a life raft for the Liberal Party. How is there any examples that you can give us now of part of the party platform, nascent as it is, or any particular policies that distinguish it from Labor, Liberal in particular?
Absolutely. And look, and as a lawyer, I have worked directly on the formation of the Constitution to ensure we embed the values and the attributes of being true to our communities. So the one MP, one vote, no party line, no whip is an essential element that we must be responsive to our communities and work with colleagues around policy. So comparing that, for example, Labor has a caucus where MPs may be able to disagree internally behind closed doors, but they cannot vote in accordance to their community wishes because they have to vote with the party line. The Liberal Party similarly might in theory have a free vote, but they never exercise it because the power brokers control the party and control pre-selection and support and the policy direction. That's where Community Strong is so different. We're forming with a community engagement committee with a particular focus. There will be a First Nations committee and a youth committee to ensure young people have a seat at the table in contributing and forming policies for Community Strong.
Well, it's certainly a different way of coming to the decisions, but are there any examples you can give of particular policy positions that would distinguish it quite clearly right now between the two major parties, or should I say Liberal and Labor?
Well, absolutely. When you look at climate and integrity and economic management, where do you go when you care about innovation and having a fair go where if you're going to work hard, you get that opportunity to get ahead, but also care about climate action and our communities being safe? We know, for example, there's huge support in the community for Australians to get much better revenue from our resources. We have multinationals exporting gas at great profit, and yet Australians pay more tax through their beer excise. And yet the major parties are just not willing to tackle these issues. They listen to vested interests, to lobby groups, to unions, but all too often they don't listen to communities. And I think a huge number of Australians are really frustrated and have had enough of that.
Well, indeed, and that's what One Nation has been profiting from. Do you think you're going to get some of those voters who otherwise would be tempted to go to One Nation?
Look, a lot of people are have been indicating that they would consider turning to One Nation because they've had enough of the status quo and they can see that the major parties, Labor and the Coalition, have been in power forever, sharing it between them, but they're not fixing or listening to they're not listening to communities. Now, people considering One Nation, I would encourage them to look to Community Strong because we are focused on solutions, not just anger and narrative and blame. It is about, you know, at the end of the day, you can name the problem, but you actually have to work on fixing the problem sensibly, responsibly. And I think that is what we have been known for as community independence. I've been for 7 years in the parliament, putting forward a lot of solutions, a lot of legislation to government, working with both sides with amendments. And so that continues to be the focus.
Before I let you go, Zali Steggall, we have seen a lot of listener feedback saying, look, if independents become part of a party, it's oxymoronic, they lose their authenticity. You've laid out a lot of structural things that you say will lead to proper consultation, etc. But isn't that a problem? Do you think that that's even a little bit of a problem, that becoming a party, you lose the authenticity of being an independent?
Look, obviously, I've thought very deeply about this. I've been in politics for 7 years now, and for me, it's really important to stay true to my pledge and commitment to Warringah, my community, why I got into politics. It was because I was so worried about climate action, around having more merit-based policies, around addressing issues of equality and domestic violence. So for me, how do I ensure a model that is true to those values and principles? And I think strongly that we have done that with the Constitution. But again, we're on the start line, right? We're announcing it's been lodged with the AEC. We're really keen to get feedback. And of course, there will be detractors. But I think it's important when you are at this critical junction of Australian politics to be bold and imagine a different way of doing politics where it's not power brokers and vested interests. It's ordinary Australians that have a say.
Zali Steggall, thank you. You have been generous with your time. Thank you for joining us on The Starting Line.
Thank you so much.
So that's Zali Steggall behind the new Community Strong Party. What do you think? She just said she's keen to get feedback. 1300 222 774. Give us your feedback as well. What did you think of what Zali had to say? See quite a few texts along the lines of, go Zali, I really hope this works. It's new, throw out the facts politics that it'll work against. So much admiration as well. Others say a vote for them is a vote for Labor. That's from Peter in Frankston South. On the name, interestingly, Steve says, great, we have a new centre party, but the name Community will give the trolls an easy two-letter graffiti opportunity about communism. Hadn't thought about that. And Paul from Southbank says, no party's ever had a name that so clearly demonstrates their enthusiasm for focus group led decision making. What do you think? Do you agree? We're going to get a little bit of analysis from the heart of it. Sean Kelly from Parliament House. So joining me now is Sean Kelly, a former advisor to a couple of Labor PMs, also the author of the latest quarterly essay, The Good Fight, who can give us an insight into how this will go down in federal politics. Thanks for joining us again, Sean.
Thanks as always for having me, Mary.
What do you think now? I think it's been a not so well kept secret around federal politics. Have they done enough to answer this question that has been sort of shadowing this whole debate about whether or not they lose their authenticity as independents? If, for instance, they've got, as Zali says, this collaborative framework, the lack of big multi-billionaire donors, is that enough?
Look, I think it is a question that can't be answered at this point, to be honest. It is the type of thing that will only become apparent over time. I think they've had a pretty good go at trying to prepare for those questions, obviously making sure that Climate 200 aren't initially involved to avoid that sense of being overshadowed by a big fundraising group. They are clearly presenting themselves as a new type of party. And I think this is really interesting because this was always going to be the challenge for them. It's exactly what you've outlined. The trying to jump from a point where their appeal was being independent, not controlled by anyone, not beholden to anyone, even colleagues, where they were community-based, very much embedded in their communities, and as you say, authentic, to this place of actually being in a different party. Well, how do you bridge that? By trying to become a different type of party to any of the parties that currently exist out there. And Zali Steggall was just outlining that. So they have these pillars of policy, which are fairly broad, but nobody will be held to particular positions. And that is very different from the way the major parties operate at this point. To me, there are a couple of questions. One is obviously how voters react. The second is whether you can actually be effective operating in that way. Because at the moment, I think it sounds fairly fuzzy. It may work, but it's obviously different from what we've seen before. And I think a question that some voters will be asking themselves is, what exactly makes this a party? Mm. You know, we've seen the rise of One Nation, obviously, and that I find pretty terrifying in many ways, but it has also opened up this space. It's shown people that something is possible that isn't just the major parties. And that's obviously a very interesting moment in the development of our democracy. And it would have been a surprise if groups like the Teals, Community Independence, hadn't jumped into it. Mm. But what One Nation has going for it, one of the things it has as an advantage is that it is a very structured party. When Pauline Hanson says something, it largely holds. You know, there's a fair bit of chaos at times, but she does have clear authority in the party. When voters come to an election, they are looking for a party to represent their interests across the nation. Yes, they could vote for community independence, but are they actually getting a party? I think that is a question people will be asking.
So that tension between grassroots community feel at a national level.
Well, exactly. How much power can you wield as a political party if you are not united around very clear policies? How much of a strong voice can a party have if the leader doesn't clearly speak for everybody in the party?
Well, now, and indeed, there is no leader. How's that going to work?
There is no leader. I did see in a report that that will shift as the party grows. Once I think it hits 10 members, they're talking about forming a leadership committee. Again, I don't know where an actual leader sits in that. But that's why I say, in a way, these questions will be answered with time. I think the nature of new parties is they tend to change, probably change fairly significantly as time goes on, because, of course, they have to deal with the circumstances in which we find them. And really, that's a way of describing the development of the Teals till now. They started as seemingly genuine independents. They have started to operate in some ways like a party, just in some ways. You know, they have talked about things, consulted each other, worked together, split up the workload into different areas of focus. These are things that parties do. And of course, they've done that because they've found themselves in parliament. They've realized that they need to make the most of their limited resources. And so they've started organically, really, to replicate the structure, the efficiencies of other parties. And so I suspect that's what you will see a bit more of as time goes on. And that's when this collision between the two halves really comes into play, that community independence on one side and party status on the other.
And as we know, we've got a number of independents, most of them holding off, presumably to see what happens. And will One Nation be the same? Sean, do you get the sense that One Nation's at all threatened by this sort of nascent movement if it does catch on?
I think they will be over time. I think One Nation is reaping a great deal of success from the fact that they are one of the only significant alternatives that people see. And so I think it is true that a lot of people, even though they may not like One Nation's actual policies, what Pauline Hanson stands for and believes, that they are putting their vote with One Nation for now because they want to see something other than what they're getting from the major parties. They want to, at the very least, register a protest at this point. And so as other parties come along, I think we will start to see that vote fragment. That will, of course, be a threat to One Nation. I don't think that will happen immediately, because realistically, calling yourself a party is a significant step. But as you say, there are still only two of them. It doesn't sound a lot like a party yet. And in a way, I think this is one of the weaknesses, obviously, is that other community independents haven't come on board yet. And I can understand why. Zali Stegelman, I think Allegra Spender explicitly has said, yes, this is clearly a risk. This is why there are only two of us at this point. It is clearly a risk to them. But without more momentum, they struggle to project that sense of power, which is one of the advantages that parties have.
Sean Kelly, it's always good to pick your brains. Thank you.
Thanks again. Bye, Mary.
Sean Kelly, former advisor to Julia Gillard and Kevin Rudd, and also author of the latest quarterly essay, The Good Fight.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
We are going to be talking about anxious pets. Are they really anxious? Is it just part of their breed? What do you do? How does your animal display anxiety? Have you turned to medication? Have you turned away from medication? Give us a call and tell me your story, because it's not just telling stories, it's getting advice as well. Dr. Kate Mornament is an animal behaviourist who can answer all of our questions. Hi, Kate.
Hi, Mary.
Thank you so much for talking to us today. I did kick off the program talking about a golden retriever. Had a bit of a quick conversation with Raf about his golden retriever, who's apparently the most chill dog. Mine is not the most chill dog. She is happy enough, but when she's around plastic bags and so forth, she's all nervy. Now, the wisdom of the dog park is divided. Yes, that's normal. No, it's not. For all of the people who are having a go at me and Raf talking about whether golden retrievers are just too dumb to feel anxious, I hear what you're saying. But Dr. Kate Mornament is here to tell me, what do you think about my particular problem, Kate?
So, look, it's a little unusual. Dogs can respond fearfully or with anxiety in response to lots of different things. So in your particular case, a plastic bag is eliciting a fear response in your dog. Mm-hmm. And fear responses occur either because of a negative past experience associated with the trigger. So perhaps she got a fright from a plastic bag if she stepped on it, or it moved, or something happened to cause a fear response, or she encountered one and just found it scary. So yeah, I mean, different animals have different personalities and quirks, and she's decided that for whatever reason plastic bags are scary.
Yeah, and look, we've just decided, okay, that's her, and otherwise she's happy. Is that fair enough?
Look, that is fair enough, but there's actually a bit you can do to reduce her fear associated with plastic bags. So she is fearful of them because of a negative association, likely due to past experiences. You can actually work on some behaviour modification to address that underlying fear and change her association with plastic bags from a negative to a more positive association.
So stick raw meat on a plastic bag?
Pretty much. So we do. We use food and we pair the scary thing with lots of yummy treats. We do it a lot. So repetition is really important, and gradual exposure. So you don't just want to shove a plastic bag in her face and pair it with food. You want to have the plastic bag a distance away and gradually lay the treats closer and closer. So she has the control to approach if she's feeling like she's being brave. But that process works. It's called desensitization and counter conditioning, and we use it routinely to help address fear in lots of different animals.
Okay. Look, enough about my Rosa. 1300 222 774 is the number to call with your questions, and I can see them piling up now. Hi, Adam in Springwood in New South Wales. Hello, thank you for listening. Tell us about your pooch, is it?
Yeah, good morning, Dr. Kate. Good morning, Dr. Mary.
Morning, Adam.
Listen to her, not me.
I've got a 26-month-old rescue dog. He's a Bull Arab cross, take your pick. And he's got something going on where he will not do his wheeze or poops or any scent marking outside of our property. So whether we're on a walk, he doesn't cock his leg or do wheeze. And if we go out to like my parents' house for 5 hours, he'll just hold and hold and hold and then leap out of the car with his paws crossed. And, you know, as soon as we're home, bang, off he goes. I was just wondering if you had any ideas what that might be about.
Kate?
I do, absolutely. So lots of rescue dogs may have come from homes where they're not used to what goes on in suburbia. So a Bull Arab, lots of them come from rural environments, and so they're not used to everyday things that we encounter living in suburbia. So going to the toilet for a dog is a vulnerable position to be in, because when they're squatting or they're toileting, they're not ready to escape potential threat. So a dog that is a lot more comfortable going to the toilet at home tells me that he's feeling a bit unsure and a bit uncertain about being vulnerable in the outside environment that's a lot less predictable. So I would just work on giving him time, but also try and use lots of treats and positive reinforcement when you're out and about to help ease any fear or anxiety that may be there. I think I have a feeling that's what's going on there, Adam. He's just a little feeling a bit unsure out and about.
Good luck with that, Adam.
Thank you.
Yep, hopefully that works out. Carol in Wallen, what would you like to ask Dr. Kate?
Hi, Dr. Kate. I've got a GSP, a German short-haired pointer. She's obsessed with shadows and reflections. She seems to get And sometimes she'll sit and just stare for a very long time.
Oh, wow. Obsessed as in just fixated on?
Yeah, very much so. She's licking her lips right next to me right now.
What do you think, Dr. Kate?
Yeah, so fixation on things like shadows or reflections or even lights, we see these commonly, particularly in working breed dogs. So it can be a bit of a self-soothing behaviour if they're feeling stressed or anxious. It can just be a behaviour that they go to. Or sometimes they can do it if there's nothing else going on in the environment to get their attention or to keep them occupied. So when I encounter dogs like that, I look at, is there anything in the environment that's causing them stress or anxiety, and they're going to that pattern behaviour to kind of relieve it? Or is she bored and she's not got a lot to do? And, you know, working dogs, they're so clever. They have been bred for a long time to do a job. So trying to provide her with lots of enrichment involving scent work and physical activity, just trying to increase the jobs that she's got to do, may help to reduce that sort of behaviour. The other important thing is to try not to give her attention when she's engaging in that behaviour, because sometimes that can inadvertently reward it.
Mm. Good luck with that, Carol. We've got a lot of calls to get on with, so we'll do that on the conversation hour. We're talking about anxiety in pets. Barb in Kyneton, tell me about your pet.
Oh, hi, Mary and Dr. Kate. I've got a Kelpie. She's 10 years old. We got her at about 7 months old, and she's fine at home and running around and happy generally, but if I pop her in the car and go off to the shops, obviously, I can't take her into the shops with me, but she lets the town know that she's alone in the car.
No.
Once I'm out of sight, it sort of stops, and she doesn't do it again. She's fine when I come back. But she's I've had medication from the vet as well for her, but I feel like, you know, zonking her for the sake of a 5 or 10 minute trip to the shops is not really worth it.
Barb, yes. Medication or not, Dr. Cato, what do you do?
So that sounds to me like she has a bit of separation anxiety when left in the car away from the home. So again, she has a negative association with being left in the car. So this is something that we can teach her to cope with by changing how she feels about being left in the car. So I would suggest to Barb to practice this at home with her in the car, and just very gradually get her used to being in there on her own for very short periods of time, giving her a long-lasting chew treat to have in the car while Barb steps away from the car for a couple of minutes, and then gradually building up the time that you're away from her while she's in the car. And once she's good at home, then start practicing when you go down the street. So, for example, you might go down the street, and before you walk off into the shops, give her a really long-lasting treat to help her learn that when you leave her, good things happen. So it's about lots of repetition and teaching her to associate being left in the car alone with good things.
Thanks. I hope that helps, Barb. We are listening to Dr. Kate Mornament, who's an animal behaviourist on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. And I want to get to more of those calls. But also, Kate, you wanted to talk about leaving dogs in cars and so forth. Are people expecting too much of their pets? I'm not suggesting anything about Barb and having a dog wait in the car. That seems reasonable. But are people also expecting too much from their pets in other circumstances, and that causes anxiety in their animals?
I think it's not that our expectations cause anxiety in our animals. It's just that it's normal to expect lots of things in our pets, but if our pets aren't coping in that situation, then we need to look at why. So, for example, a lot of people, you know, we work and they have to go away every day for 8 hours all day to work, but leaving a dog home alone for that period of time every day can be really difficult for some dogs to cope with. So we need to help them learn how to cope. A lot of the time we take for granted what the behaviours are that we expect our pets to exhibit, but actually we need to teach them how to cope in the environments that we place them in. So teaching a dog to cope with separation is a learned behaviour. We actually need to teach them how to do that, not expect that they'll just learn.
Mara in Belgrave, what did you want to ask Dr. Kate?
Yes, hi. Our dog seems to have PTSD from when she was a puppy. I mean, we got her at that usual 8 weeks sort of, you know, pick up. We've only treated her with love for the 8 or so years that we've had her, but she still triggers the trauma every now and again. I think as she's getting older, she's getting arthritis pains and that kind of, I don't know whether she's like going, I'm in pain, that means the person nearest me is causing me pain, I must lash out. But I'm just kind of like, does it, our sort of like love to her doesn't seem to be really kind of softening that trauma.
Interesting question, Mara.
Yes, Mara. So trauma or traumatic events that dogs can experience as a puppy or in the first year of life particularly can have lifelong consequences on how they perceive certain things. And we also know that experiencing pain can contribute to fear and anxiety as well. So I would suggest trying to get on top of that pain so that the pain isn't an issue, because it doesn't matter how much behaviour modification we do. If the pain is triggering that response, it needs to be addressed. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is thinking back to what the traumatic event was or the trigger, and again, trying to work to change how she feels about that trigger very gradually using desensitization and that counter conditioning I spoke about before, where you pair the presence of the trigger with something the dog really, really loves. And you do it gradually and with lots of repetition, and it does help to reduce that trauma response. I will say, though, with some animals, they do benefit a lot from medication to help reduce their fear and anxiety to allow them to learn how to cope.
Mara, I'm sure your pooch does not have that love wasted on him. Thank you so much for the call. I'll try and squeeze in a quick one from Susan in Merbeau North, representing the cat owners amongst us. Hi, Susan, what's your question?
Oh, hi. Yes, we've got a 1-year-old kitten, and we got her when she was about 8 weeks old. And she's as placid as anything when we got her. And in the last maybe couple of months, if we try and pick her up or move her to a spot, or she'll start sort of hissing at us and trying to bite us if we want to. We have an enclosure outside we take her to, and if we want to bring her inside, she'll hiss at us and try and scratch. And I'm just not sure why she's doing that all of a sudden.
Okay. Yeah, Susan. So that's, so I've seen this many times before in cats. So they may do it because when they're picked up, something is painful or something hurts. So it's important to rule that out, an underlying physical issue that may be causing pain. But she may also be doing it because she doesn't want to come inside, or she doesn't want to be picked up or taken somewhere else. And if that's the case, what you can do is go out there with some really yummy treats. I don't know if you've seen the cat treats in the straw, the soft food, I think they're churros or something like that. Go out there and show her the treats and let her have a lick, and then pick her up and keep giving her treats so that she learns that being picked up in that situation can be a positive experience, and that should help resolve that aggression.
Susan, I do hope that helps. We've run out of time with Dr. Kate, and I apologise to everyone who's been texting in. I think we need to make this a semi-regular segment, Dr. Kate, but thank you so much for helping all of our anxiety, humans and otherwise, today.
Such a pleasure. Thank you, Mary.
Dr. Kate Mornament is an animal behaviourist, and you can find out more about Kate on the website called Pets Behaving Badly. That's all one word, petsbehavingbadly.com.au, if you'd like to look it up. And yes, let's keep talking about our wonderful pooches and pets on the Conversation Hour. But also, before we finish up today, you may have heard some overnight news about the last of the women associated with Islamic State. We heard all but one from the northeastern camps in Syria had returned. That one had a temporary exclusion order. Overnight, we heard that that person is coming home. We'll have an explanation of that next.
Charlie Pickering.
Be part of our live TGIF audience in South Bank this Friday with Kirsty Wiebeck, Oliver Coleman, Nick Schuller, and a live performance by Anthony Kalia. Book your free tickets via the 774 ABC Melbourne website.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
So on that story, you might have woken up to this morning that the one woman, and I believe a child is with her, who had been subject to a temporary exclusion order because intelligence agencies had assessed her as posing a significant national security risk, well, she will be allowed to come home. Tony Burke, the Minister for Home Affairs, Immigration, Citizenship and Cybersecurity, said that that temporary exclusion order applies until a permit is issued, and when a permit is requested, that permit lawfully has to be issued. So let's have a little listen to him about the situation. Here he is on AM.
Request's been made. We received the final advice yesterday that post-entry conditions, that's all the surveillance conditions, there's a whole series of conditions we can put in place there, but we received the final advice yesterday that we can no longer have an exclusion condition any longer for her. We've checked with our agencies. They are ready. So that permit gets issued.
That permit gets issued as a matter of law, according to Tony Burke. The Shadow Minister for Defence, James Patterson, has been on Sky News today. He was describing Tony Burke's explanation as, quote, a rather tortured attempt to say it wasn't his fault.
But the bottom line is the Albanese Labor government has issued a return permit to a member of ISIS, an affiliate of ISIS, to return to our country who was previously blocked from returning to our country. This is a government which has failed at every turn when it comes to the management of these so-called ISIS brides, really just ISIS members, who left our country to join a abhorrent terrorist organisation that viciously persecuted, murdered, raped and tortured people.
So we thought it was worth the time to look at this. You might be a bit confused as to what the situation is, and who better to ask than Professor Don Rothwell, who's an expert in international law at the ANU. Thank you so much for joining us, Don.
Hi, Mary.
What do you believe is the situation here? What options did the government have?
Look, I think we need to start by saying that all of this is quite unprecedented. The general circumstances under which the government can issue temporary exclusion orders under legislation adopted in 2019 have been very rare. They've been quite exceptional. We know that in this particular instance, this TEO was issued for this individual back in February. And now, for the very first time, to my knowledge, we've had the minister receive an application to revoke the temporary exclusion order. And as you've just been outlining, the minister deciding to revoke the order and issue an entry permit. So never before, to my knowledge, has this element of the relevant Commonwealth legislation been explored. So we're really in completely uncharted territory here. Okay, and I guess what the minister did not do when he gave his interview today was to give any explanation as to his reasons as to why he's decided to revoke the TEO.
Interesting you should say that, because my impression is from Tony Burke that he had no choice, that he says that when a permit is requested, a permit lawfully has to be issued. You say it's more of a decision that he could make. Is that right?
Yes. Obviously, the minister has a capacity to make a ministerial decision. They exercise their judgment. They exercise their discretion in this matter. Otherwise, the issuing of a TEO could easily be overturned by exactly the type of processes that we're seeking at the moment. So under Section 12 of the Act, an individual who's subject to a TEO can seek a revocation order. The legislation is very broad in terms of what it says. It says that the individual seeking the revocation of the order merely has to specify the reasons why they are seeking to have the TEO revoked. Now, as I said, this is all completely unprecedented. We don't have any other examples of this having occurred previously. But obviously, the minister was convinced on the basis of the application made before him that the TEO could be revoked in this instance.
So are we then to sit back and assess whether this is a genuine good faith legal analysis that has come from the department about what is necessary, or to consider this, I guess, a political decision is how you'd say it. What do you think, Don Rothwell?
Look, I think it's a bit of both, because the minister quite rightly referred to the fact that he's received legal advice, which is entirely appropriate, given the circumstances that I've been outlining for you, that yes, we have this legislation in place, but it's been completely untested. So it's more than appropriate that ministers seek extensive legal advice as to how he should go about it. But ultimately, a judgment has to be made, and it's a political judgment by the relevant minister. It's not exceptional that ministers make these sort of judgments. They do so on a very regular basis. But the minister has to be convinced as to the grounds upon which the revocation has been sought by this individual.
You're listening to Don Rothwell, who's an expert in international law at ANU. We're talking about what he describes as an exceptional, untested power that Tony Burke is exercising in this case of a woman who's returning from northern eastern Syrian camps. So in terms of that then, does that mean that if this is untested and this is a precedent, essentially, I guess, that Tony Burke is establishing, can it be challenged in any way?
Most unlikely at the moment, because the individual who sought the revocation of the order has got the outcome that they sought. So they're hardly going to test it in the court.
But no other parties, no other political parties?
No. I see it's being most unlikely that this would be tested in this particular instance. Of course, we've had a lot of political debate over the last few months as to whether or not this legislation is sufficiently watertight. The coalition has from time to time suggested that they're very much open to toughening this legislation, but there's been no concrete proposals put forward, and there's certainly been no debate in Parliament about any amendments to this legislation.
I read some reporting that seemed to suggest, or maybe it was through the government's briefings, that essentially bans like this, the temporary bans, and I'm paraphrasing here, are sort of there to buy time to put conditions in place because this mechanism is available to someone who's the subject of one of these orders. It sounds like from your point of view, though, that's not really how those powers were written. It's not necessarily so temporary as to just allow a reprieve before someone, you know, puts in a request.
Very much so. And of course, when a temporary exclusion order is issued, and the minister made this point back in February, it's issued initially for a period of 2 years, and there's some mechanisms under which that could be further extended. But yes, the legislation is also broad enough that if it's revoked under the circumstances that we're now discussing, the minister can impose very, very significant conditions on the individual on their return to Australia, and Tony Burke has outlined the range of options that he has available to him under the legislation to that end, and he's also received legal advice on that point. It needs to be noted that there's another exceptional aspect of this legislation, and that is that this individual can only return to Australia if they're issued a return permit. It's absolutely exceptional that an Australian citizen has to seek a return permit to be able to return to Australia, but it applies as a result of this particular piece of legislation. So people crossing the border in Melbourne today, when they're returning to Tullamarine from overseas, of course, don't have return permits. They're just entering Australia with their Australian passport. So this notion of a return permit is also another very unique aspect of this legislation, and the minister can put conditions on the return permit, and Tony Burke's spoken about that today.
But what you're saying is that return permit isn't necessarily automatic. It's just that's what's happened this time.
Correct.
Yeah. Don Rothwell, we live in interesting times, and it's so good to have you explain them to us. Thank you.
Pleasure to speak. Bye now.
Professor Don Rothwell is, of course, expert in international law at ANU. Look, there's a few more minutes left to go in the conversation hour, and I just wanted to replay to you something very special happened on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria this morning. If you missed it, Bob Murphy, our ABC Melbourne breakfast legend, of course, if you're listening in the regions, you know him anyway from the footy. He made his way to the State Library this morning. It's Global Beatles Day. And I just wanted to let you all listen again because it was just glorious. Because it's Global Beatles Day, the universal message is all you need is love. And so this is what Bob and the choir he assembled had as a tribute.
There's nothing you can do that can't be done. Nothing you can sing that can't be sung. Nothing you can say, you can learn how to play the game. It's easy. Nothing you can make that can't be made. Nothing you can save that can't be saved. Nothing you can do, you can learn how to be with time. It's easy.
Take that with you today. That was Bob Murphy and joined by multiple choirs. Thank you for joining me on the Conversation Hour today. You can listen again on the ABC Listen app. Write to me at conversationhour@abc.net.au. Talk to you tomorrow.